Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's the great South African group Ladysmith Mambazo singing Shosholozo. Ladysmith Black Mambazo won a Grammy today in 1987. On the way to this conversation, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner. So we are going to talk in this next part of our program about bills that many of us don't really know that are taking place. These are bills that we have not heard talked about by Governor Hogan in his State of the State address or on the pushes he's making or anywhere else. And many of these bills that are really important to the life of a city and especially life of people in a city and women in particular fly under the radar. So we are going to talk about those this hour with our three guests here joining us today. And we are joined here by Jacqueline Barge. Jacqueline Barge is founder and director of Power Inside, a project of fusion partnerships. Mathena James Brightfield is with us. She is director of community education and training with Turnaround Inc. and a visionary director of Heal a Woman, Heal a Nation. And it's Lisa, is that right?
It is Lisa, yes.
Making sure. It was written on my page a little weird. I would make sure I had it right. Lisa Jordan, who is executive director and legislative counsel for the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And Lisa, Mathena, Jackie, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Oh, yeah. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can also write an email to us at talkingsteinershow.org, tweet me at Mark Steiner, or log on to our Facebook pages. But join us if you can, 410-319-8888 by phone. It's good to have Lisa, Mathena, and Jackie with us here on this program. So let me start, Jackie, to talk about these bills, because I think people are not aware of them, and I think they are flying under the radar for most people, whether it's the House Bill 244 or House Bill 301 or Senate Bill 566. Could you just outline what these bills are, then we can kind of get to the heart of everything?
Well, yeah, sure. And I know Lucia Mancina can add to the bills they're working on, but there are a few bills that we think are really important to women in our community. And they fall at the intersections of race, class, and gender, which often times we aren't looking at the full picture when we're advocating for bills that are supposedly helping women. So when we look at it from that lens, the Maryland Second Chance Act is a very, very sound bill for women. And the reason is that women who are excessively targeted by police contact are often involved in lower level, status level, or drug crimes, including drug possession, loitering, prostitution, and the like. And so the Maryland Second Chance Act will allow for shielding of records after a 3-year waiting period of these nonviolent misdemeanors that are often accumulated to the tune of 10, 20, 30 prostitution and drug charges. And so we think that's a very smart bill that will allow the most vulnerable women to find housing, go back to work, get an education. So that's one of the bills that we're supporting, and Job Opportunities Task Force is taking the lead on that. Another bill that we think is very important, particularly to women with mental illness, transgendered women, and youthful women, is to require the state of Maryland to document and detail the use of solitary confinement. So solitary confinement is used at twice the rate in Maryland than it is around the country, and we think that is troubling. But even more troubling is we don't know really who's in solitary confinement for how long, what their sexual orientation or what their gender identity is. And so we're supporting that bill to learn what is going on in our facilities so that we can help understand, is this being used as a punishment Or is this instead of proper mental health treatment, for example, or to segregate people with sexual orientations or gender identities that they cannot keep safe out in the general population? The other bill that I think is extremely important is the Reforms to the Law Officers Bill of Rights. This, at the heart of this bill, is victims' rights. We support this bill and the reform of the Law Officers Bill of Rights because it is about ensuring that every perpetrator of sexual and physical brutality is held accountable, and there is a pathway to stop those bad officers who they probably are the minority of officers, but to stop them from brutalizing and breaking trust with the community. And again, because women are poor and vulnerable and accessible to police officers, they are coming to my agency with stories of sexual assault, sexual misconduct that is very, very sticky to try and get a handle on, and how to hold the police officers accountable. The Reform to the Law Officers Bill of Rights will restore some sanity to how we hold police accountable.
Mathias, always good to have you in the studio.
Always a pleasure.
So tell me the things that I want to kind of get a broad sense of this and then tie them all together in this conversation. So what are you working on?
So one of the things, and I think Lisa can speak to this more because she does such a fabulous job when
we'll
it comes
go right to
legislation.
Her then in just a second. Go ahead.
But I think one of the things that become really important as we focus on what's coming up, what's hitting in our communities, is looking and making sure that individuals who are victims of violent crime have the right to have access to the resources that they need, in addition to making sure that they have access to the resources when it comes to getting representation, as well as the protection for them who are currently in the workforce that have to leave their employment due to issues related to domestic violence and issues of sexual assault. So I know Lisa can elaborate more.
Go ahead, Lisa. Lisa Jordan.
Yeah, thanks. And it's so nice to be here with such fabulous advocates for women and people with limited means, and to be on your show, Mark. Thank you. There are a bunch of different bills that I wanted to mention. One is a bill about what happens if you become pregnant as a result of rape. And so this is Senate Bill 78 and House Bill 606. And, you know, when I talk in the community, people are often really shocked to find out that if they become pregnant as a result of rape, the rapist has full parental rights, just the same as anyone else. And this is just so disrespectful to women. It is, frankly, so disrespectful to men who are, you know, kind of good fathers and not conceiving children through rape. And we're very attentive to making sure that this bill passes this year. Especially important about this bill is that it be on clear and convincing evidence. Now, it's a family law bill, right? We're not talking about convicting people. We're not talking about putting people in jail. It's a family law bill. And in all of the other cases in America, if you are terminating parental rights, you do it on this high standard of clear and convincing evidence. But you don't require a conviction. And our view is, for rape victims, you know, no more, no less. We shouldn't say, oh, rape victims suddenly have to have this crime proven by a conviction. But we also understand that terminating parental rights is serious. So clear and convincing evidence is the standard that should be used here. The other thing the bill requires is that no matter what else, even if you prove by clear and convincing evidence that the child's conceived by rape, you still have to look and see what's in the best interest of the child, because, you know, that's always an important thing.
So listen, I just want to ask this one question, come back to how we tie these things together here, which I'm going to do, but I think there are a lot of issues around women's rights and also the issues raised in the state's attorney's race here. I want to raise with you about a bill that people are putting into about that, but just getting to this piece, I mean, how do you determine that a woman was impregnated by rape if a person has been charged?
The same way you determine anything else. You go to court and you have a trial. You have evidence, you have testimony, and you prove your case. We terminate parental rights based on, for instance, parents who are using drugs to the point where they can't care for their children, and we don't require that there be a criminal charge there. We terminate parental rights based on child abuse, which of course is a crime, but we don't require that there be a conviction before we terminate the parental rights of the person committing the child abuse. I mean, this is the it's really really the same situation, and we shouldn't view rape victims with kind of more suspicion. That's disrespectful to them. And, you know, Mark, it also, it's not going to do anything because so few rapes are reported, so few rapes, even when they are reported, are prosecuted. And sadly, even when they are reported and prosecuted, so often, you know, there's no conviction. And so, you know, requiring conviction is just pretending to do something without really helping the women who need help. And I just have one more thing I have to say about this, and that's that it's, you know, it's a choice issue also, because I have sat in my office counseling women who are pregnant as a result of rape, and, you know, one of the things that they're thinking about is, should I have this child or should I terminate this pregnancy? And when you explain to them that if they do have the child, the rapist has full parental rights, well, you can understand how that really affects their decision. And that's a really bad thing to have affect their decision.
So let me ask three of this question about this. What I was trying to get to, but this is kind of put it in a little more succinct way from somebody who's written in here. I mean, good question, because people hearing this right now are saying, how is this not already law? Is this going to pass, is the question. And then the follow-up here was, I know some legislators talked about the burden of proof being too low compared to our justice system in the bill, the way it's written now. So that where would it really take us?
Well, I think that actually I don't know that I would agree with that. Of the Judiciary Committee, which has 22 members, we have 18 of the members of the Judiciary Committee on as co-sponsors at the clear and convincing evidence level. In the Senate, we have 30 of the 47 senators on as sponsors of the bill, and you know they all understand that clear and convincing is the appropriate level of proof. So, I mean, are people raising that issue? Of course, we should always raise issues. We should talk about them. We should make sure that we understand, you know, why we're creating policies and proposing policies the way we're proposing them. But I do feel like there's overwhelming support for the bill. It's really just a question of whether it's going to be brought up for a vote in both committees. It has been voted on in past years in the Senate. It's always gotten through the Senate. It's never been voted on in the Judiciary Committee. We're hoping that this year is the year and are really urging that committee to vote the bill either up or down.
So folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts on these issues. I think there's so many things here. One of the bills that you all are not talking about, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the bills you are talking about very directly. But I remember during the state's attorney's race, there was a big debate over how cases cannot be, I don't know what the right legal term is, but you would, Lisa, co-joined, brought together around with rapists, so a rapist can get off much more easily. When he is arrested and then tried, and this was a problem in the big case that Baltimore's been following. So that's another bill. Is there something around that bill being put in as well? Do we know?
Yeah, there are at least two, and I'm expecting actually at least one more bill addressing that issue. So happy to talk about that.
I mean, one of the things that always shocks me in this is Mathana is how it seems that when these bills around women's rights, and some of them sound so fundamental. And so simple, not like this, you know, like this is a complex issue here.
Right.
Always seem to be on the back burner. Always seem to be things that don't get the light of day in the press, mm-hmm. that are not like just made sure that they happen. Always seem to have a hard time, for whatever reason, getting out of committee and onto the floor.
I think one of the things that we combat in any issue dealing with women, whether it's in policy and politics or so on, is that we tend to see the society that we live in doesn't tend to see that women they're not contributors to society. They're an integral part of society. And so the things that affect what goes on with women, children, and so on need not be a part of the conversation. It is the conversation. So instead of always looking at things being a part of or a contribution to, it just is. And why don't we look at it as just is? It's because we're made to be second-class citizens, but still used as a weapon, if you will, in various types of acts of wars. If we look at wars, the number one weapon used in any war is the rape and the assault of the women in that community. So we're not a contributor. We are an integral part of the communities that we live in. And so instead of being on the back burner, we need to be, we are there as women, those of us who are on the line, those who are listening, but also looking at those who kind of shift these levels of power, if you will, for them to understand that and to see that as part of the reality and not part of.
Yeah, I think that I mean, this is important. I think this discussion is important to have. One of the reasons we want to do this in this program today this way, and was brought to our attention by one of our producers, Stephanie Mavronis, is that we don't see these issues as a whole, you know, because there are all these separate different bills being put in, but they're all deeply connected, it seems to me, Jackie. Then I think that's part of the – and before we go to break here, we're just going to touch on that a little bit because I think all these bills are connected.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Mark, and it while it, some of it seems quite simple, like not allowing rapists to get custody, which we fully support.
Yeah, it's almost insane to even think that bill has to be passed.
Yeah, and as well as clearing and understanding the rape kit backlog that Lisa is working on, and also understanding what types of backlog the police have in terms of not even turning in rape kits at all. I mean, we're really, really troubled by that because the most vulnerable rape survivors are possibly the ones that may not have their rape kit even processed, which is deeply disturbing. And we see firsthand the trauma of never even knowing what happens to the rape kit at all. But other things are more complicated and need some unpacking. For example, there is a bill to make certain aspects of prostitution a felony, not a misdemeanor. Now, it's titled that it is about adult survivors of human trafficking, where some of the activities nestled under that bill are actually activities of people who might be engaged in survival sex or groups of adult youth working together for their own survival and safety, where we might have survival activities now ramped up to a felony under the auspices of helping victims. And so we're very watchful of those bills for victims that create collateral consequences for Black women, for women with mental illness, for poor women, and the like.
I think that we're going to take a break here, but I want to come back. What I want to hit the ground with is this question of survival activity. What does survival sex mean? I mean, I think because we're using terms here that may make sense to the three of you because you're activists, but make very little sense to most people listening. So I'm gonna break that down to explain what we're talking about here, and what these felonies would be, and why, and how people have to react to that, as well as the things we're talking about in the bills that your organizations are presenting. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Please join us for this conversation. We want to hear your thoughts on all of this. On our way to break, we're hearing Do Re Mi Fa, The Sound of Music Today in 1965. It was the world premiere of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical in New York. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice community. And to my cool jazz, that's Swing to Bop by the great Charlie Christian. Today in 1941, we lost this Hall of Fame swing and jazz guitarist, one of the greats. Charlie Christian passed away today in 1941. As we go back to our conversation, I want to encourage you all to listen to this. Are you interested in being part of a focus group and donating 2 hours of your time to help us make our series Sound Bites even better? That's a series we do every Tuesday in our second hour, where we talk about food and agriculture, environment, and our future together. We want to make that a much more relevant piece and have you to help us do that. We'll provide a meal and a chance to meet our staff and other Steiner Show listeners on March 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. So please join our focus group. We need your help to help us be better. For more information, you can email Valerie Williams at Valerie, that's V-A-L-E-R-I-E, Valerie at SteinerShow.org, and join us for that evening and your fellow listeners and other staff members here for that conversation. We are joined here by Jacqueline Robarge, who is the founder and director of Power Inside, a project of fusion partnerships. Mathina James Brightful, who is director of community education and training with Turnaround Inc. and visionary director of for Heal a Woman, Heal a Nation. Lisa Jordan is executive director and legislative counsel for the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault. 410-319-8888 is the number to call us. We really do want to hear from you. Please call 410-319-8888. Some of the people are tweeting in. We'll get to that in a minute. And also, you can tweet us at Mark Steiner or email us at talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. But let's break down what we talked about, this idea of survival sex first. And then I want to talk about what it means to create this as a felony. So what is what do we mean by survival sex? What is that?
So, Mark, Power Inside defines survival sex as a form of sex work that is driven by race, class, and gender oppression, where sex is used as payment for things that should be endowed to us by international human rights. For example, trading sex for a place to sleep, trading sex to avoid arrest, trading sex to see your children, those types of things. But there is not a perpetrator per se other than oppression. And sometimes there is a intimate partner or possibly a manager or a controller or a pimp, but the prevailing factors are economic and racial and gender injustice that tracks people into a form of survival where sex is commodified.
And so how is that how is that being turned into, Lisa, and we'll come right back to Mathina here, how's that being turned into a felony? What does that mean?
Well, you know, I think that there are two bills that are just right on target for this particular issue. One is there is a desire by some to view all human trafficking as a felony, and I think that bill it's as Jackie said, we had to really unpack it, and there are going to be some amendments proposed to try to make sure that, you know, women who are caught in these situations, who are somehow involved in what essentially is the marketing and commodification of other women, will be able to not be treated as felons. So we want to keep the option of a misdemeanor charge for those cases. But I think that there's another bill that's even more important for this issue of survival sex, and that's House Bill 905. And that bill creates two affirmative defenses. And so what an affirmative defense is, it's when you say, yep, you're right, I did that, I committed the crime, but here's why, and here's why I should not be convicted. The classic example is you kill someone else in self-defense. You say, yep, I killed them, but it was self-defense. This one says, if you're charged with prostitution, there are two affirmative defenses. One is to say, you know what? I committed prostitution, but I was a survivor of human trafficking. Somebody else was in charge of pushing me to do this. But the other one essentially is, yeah, I committed prostitution, but it was survival sex. Now, we don't use the phrase survival sex in the bill, but what we do is we say that if you were prostituting yourself because you needed something that's a necessity, you know, food, shelter, diapers for your kids, that should be an affirmative defense, because we should really be punishing the Johns, the customers, not the women who are in the situation where they're just trying to survive.
Mathina, because one of the things I think we're talking about here in terms of women, but also in terms of transgender people and people who define their sexuality in different ways, live their sexuality in different ways, I should say. We're talking about the people who are the most desperate, the most disenfranchised people in our culture and society.
Absolutely, and then we're also talking about those who are young. We're
yes.
talking about youth,
right, right.
In particular, who are introduced even to this concept of survival sex. I mean, one of our clients, one of the ones that we worked with, one of the first ideas and stories of this that I even saw was a young girl who was put out by her grandmother. She was about 13 or 14 years old, put out by her grandmother and told every day, don't come back unless you come back with $50. At 13 or 14 years old, how am I supposed to do that? And so I'm introduced to this concept of having a foreign place to stay, not getting in trouble when I go back home by finding ways to produce this money. And then you have those who exploit that by saying, hey, this is how you can get it. And they're introduced into this concept and this lifestyle of living. So, and then you take individuals who are transgendered, who are in the LGBT community, who are even, their communities are even smaller, right? They're even smaller than many of the communities that most of us operate in. And so the exploitation that occurs is rampant. And then when you look at the history, many of these individuals have histories of childhood sexual abuse. So that history all combines, so like we were talking about before, nothing happens in a vacuum by itself. Very often these things are connected with each other in some way.
So I'm curious what the response is to these things. I mean, on the House floor so far, I mean, we all have to be optimistic in our work, but I'm also curious, Jackie, what you think is the reality of what people are saying in response to things like the Second Chance Act, when people think that, oh, prostitution plagues my neighborhood, these people need to go to jail.
Well, you know, one of the reasons I'm sure people are concerned about prostitution and drug possession is because of the clash with the neighborhood seeing what's going on in the community, the poverty, the drug addiction. But criminalization alone does not solve the problem. And we know this, it's been very time tested over the last 30 years. The criminalization of drugs and prostitution will not stop the social inequities that cause these problems. So, you know, some of it is around information. And I think some of it is also just for folks to face the painful reality that these are not those people, that there are many people, students today, professionals, who have, you know, that are in recovery or are current drug users, are in prostitution or not. And so this is not a, you know, otherizing does not help. But when prostitution is visible, we kind of assume that's the only way it looks. And the way it looks on the streets of Baltimore is a very, very desperate situation. But if we took a fraction of the dollars used to, you know, do patrols and enforcement and stings for prostitution, and actually, quite frankly, trying to rescue homeless teenagers from prostitution and put it into evidence-based programs that have been known to get people off the street and youth off the street, you would see an entirely different result. And we actually could get people into housing, could get people into health care in a way that we have never seen before. But I'm afraid that, you know, I'm not a very good legislative advocate because I think so many of these problems are social and socially bound, and we need to put things into social problems, and that includes human trafficking. You know, when I started anti-violence work 20-some-odd years ago, it was around stopping and ending violence against women. And the battered women's movement, it has morphed and changed so much to be defined by criminal penalties and not changing our culture, and that troubles me.
Mathana, what were you raising your hand yes for?
Yeah, thanks, Jackie, for saying that, because that was the thing. The cultural shift is where the real change happens. If you think about how we work with abusers and anything, take seatbelts, for example. Seatbelt changes were a cultural change more than it was. People were still getting locked up when they first began to institute those bills and laws. Not that that doesn't mean it's not necessary, but the cultural change around you're safer, your children are safer when you buckle up, that's the cultural change that's long-lasting.
So, and Lisa, so when you do this work in the legislature, I mean, how do you think you get to the place these other two women are talking about?
Well, I'm very aware that the law and the legislative work that we do is just like one teeny part of changing the culture. And I think that ultimately the work that Mathina and Jackie are doing to change the culture, it's key. We're not going to get anywhere unless we do that. At the same time, the clients that we work here with at the Sexual Assault Legal Institute, the words on the page matter, the words in our laws matter, and it's my 20th legislative session, and I'm still astounded that I say things like, yeah, if you're a rapist, you have full parental rights. On the other hand, we have made progress, and we're going to keep making progress, but it really takes all of us as activists calling our legislators, not getting so disgusted that they're not getting anywhere and they're not getting it, but like holding them to task and saying, you know, no, you need to listen to us. Women matter. Women need to be in the legislature. You need to listen to our voices. And, you know, we're not part of the conversation. We are the conversation. I think that that's really key. So I know it's frustrating. I know it's not everything, but it's really important that we talk to the people in Annapolis and we make them make things better.
So on the heels of what you just said and what Mathina said earlier about the issue and aspects of them, because they are the issue. It's not something separate from that. I'm curious, Jackie, how go around the room with this, how you all think that the hearings are going. I mean, what is the response and the issues being raised there? What's been your experience there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the shielding bill, the Maryland Second Chance Act, is going quite well. I mean, I've been to the expungement hearings over the years, and now the Shielding and Job Opportunities Task Force has done a tremendous job educating folks on how many different groups of folks will be impacted by this, and we are coming in on it from our client's angle that it is very important that women who are poor and have a criminal record are allowed to go back to work and find housing. I mean, it's really been stellar. I do think the stigma, though, runs very deep. And so we don't know what happens behind closed doors. I mean, I noticed that with the working on the shackling of incarcerated pregnant women, that we really don't know what the conversations are or what the lobbying efforts are behind the scenes.
And Lefana, you've been down to Annapolis watching this?
I listen and read all of MCASA's legislative briefs that come out in the MADV. But one of the things I think was important, and I know Lisa probably mentioned this, is even though when you look at what happens on our college campuses with the college, that affirmative policy that they're looking at instituting, a lot of this takes some time to vet and really go through in detail. This is it's incredibly important to include all of these pieces in the conversation. And it's funny because off air we were talking about another issue, Mark, but I think the same thing applies here. It's not either or. It takes all of these methods in order for us to have impact.
Folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. I, you know, we've had these for the last 23 years in this program. We have been talking to lots of women who have lived life on the street and are battling to change their lives and to help other women in that situation, with communities that are trying to change the way we address that and are to reach out and help people and bring them in. And I think that there's a these are bills. I think part of the problem is, Lisa Jordan, is sometimes these bills are not capturing the public's eye and ear and the importance of it. And I think that one of the reasons we're doing the show today is because of that, that people have to kind of don't even know this is happening or these issues are of any import.
Yeah, Mark, I think that you're absolutely right, and that's why I really appreciate you having the three of us on the show, and I hope that people are listening.
Oh, they are.
We just updated our legislative priorities at MCASA, and I've got 7 pages of bills. You know, so it's there are many bills that are being introduced, but I think that one thing Matthias said that's totally true is that the devil's in the details of these bills, and that's what I'm watching in these committees. I'm watching them listen to these things. I'm watching them, you know, nobody comes out and says, hey, I'm for human trafficking or sexual assault is great. They don't say that.
Right.
But they pick away at the details of the bills. They say, oh, yeah, I'm against sexual violence, but you know, this thing about rapists and babies, let's hold these women to a higher standard. And, you know, and the affirmative or the affirmative defense to prostitution, yeah, human trafficking is okay, but survival sex, we don't care about those women. It's like those sorts of granular details that really make a difference in the lives of women. And we do. We have to pay attention to those details. And, you know, I can't pay attention to every single detail, but I do pay attention to every single detail about human sex trafficking, sexual assault, and child sexual abuse. That's why MCASA's there in Annapolis. And I think that Jackie and many of the folks at the Job Opportunities Task Force are really in Annapolis paying attention to every single detail about the Second Chance Act. And, you know, the folks in the community, even if you don't have the bandwidth to, like, look at all 7 pages of the priorities, you need to know we're there. You need to know who to call to ask. And when we send an email saying, hey, please call people today, you know, I just hope you respond.
And, you know, I think this is a piece I'm going to raise here with this, because I think that, again, when we talk about survival sex and these second chances and what all that means, I think that's why I keep pushing this notion of what survival sex is and how that works, is I think that we are in a culture where people believe in personal responsibility, that you have a choice in these matters, and that you have to pay the consequences for your own personal choices, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the disconnect for some people. Mm-hmm. The other disconnect is that people live in communities where prostitution is very visible, and it troubles people, and they don't know what to do about it. And so law enforcement is always the easiest answer, Mathina, which is one of the problems, I think, which is why people have a hard time reporting on this. But they should not have a hard time reporting on this issue. But people have a hard time kind of understanding this issue in a certain way, which is what we're trying to get to here.
one of the things I think is critical is if you do have something going on in your community and you think it's not right and you want to do something about it, Google is your friend. Look up organizations that are actively involved in this type of work. Power Inside, Turnaround, MCASA, MNADV, House of Ruth. All these organizations and institutions are asking for your support and your assistance. You can find us all over the web. And in addition to coming to our offices, our communities, to connect with us and ask us how you can support. And we have a long list of ways that you can do so. In addition to that, understanding the cultural impact. People like to separate themselves because then that means it's not them, it's someone else's responsibility, someone else's problem, versus looking at the individuals who are in their very own backyards until it hits even within their family that they now realize, okay, I have to do something about this issue. And when we talk about this concept of choice, we have to look at the impact of all the other things surrounding it. We did the same thing with the years over domestic violence. When you look at the reality that the person doesn't have the same access to economic freedom as many of these individuals who are saying, well, yes, you have a choice in this matter. They don't have that same access. They don't have that same access to support, whether it's shelter programming or safe housing. Those things don't exist for them in the same way it may show up for other people. When you look at the fact that a number of these individuals, a number of our sisters and brothers who experienced this, they may come out of a space where they don't have family members and that kind of support system that allows them to have a place to go. So it's not happening outside of, it's happened within our communities and within our own homes and families.
So let me go through this again with the three of you, because I want people to understand what these bills are, and I also want people to be able to react to them. And we're going to put them on our website so people can see the bills and see how to respond to them, how to connect them, and how to let their legislators know how they feel about these things. But I want to make sure we just run down them very quickly here and get a sense of them before we have to go to our next segment. So Jackie, let's just end up very, very quickly. I mean, the Second Chance Act.
A Second Chance Act is, HB 244. There's a Senate bill as well, and that is to shield many nonviolent misdemeanor convictions after a three-year wait. And Job Opportunities Task Force is taking the lead on that. There is also the bill HB 301. ACLU is taking a lead on that to understand the use of solitary confinement. The Law Officers Bill of Rights is SB 566, which is a very important provision to restore some victims' rights in the process of police accountability. And the Lise can talk about the affirmative defense, which we are, on pause about because there are collateral consequences to a lot of these human trafficking bills. And those are the ones that I have.
And I think that people don't realize that we have, as you say in the piece that you put out for this for the HB House Bill 301, that Maryland has double the national average of people who are put in segregation in isolated units, and how this affects people, and so many of them who are in these units are mentally ill, and have very serious issues, juveniles and lots of women, and so this is something that people don't really know as well as they should. So it's a really important bill. Lisa Jordan.
Well, the bill that we started talking about was Senate Bill 78, and that's the Rape Survivor Family Protection Act. That's the act that would allow a woman who is raped and becomes pregnant as a result of the rape to ask the court to end the parental rights of the rapist, and that would be so she could give the child up for adoption without asking the rapist for permission. And then if she decided to raise the child herself, it wouldn't actually end the parental rights of the rapist. It would just limit his access to the child. And so, again, that's Senate Bill 78.
The other bill we've talked about here was that there's been a lot of debate around the Law Enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights. And one of these bills, Senate Bill 566, also talks about the Senate Bill, the Law Officers' Bill of Rights, the Law Enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights. But very specifically, Jackie, this one is about women who have been sexually molested or attacked by police officers, and that...
That is where we come in with our concerns. That is not the intent of this bill. This is the main law, reform to Law Officers' Bill of Rights, but I don't think people are considering how difficult it would be for someone who is a victim of sexual brutality by a police officer to get themselves together enough to report it to the police within 90 days. There are a lot of process getting something notarized. The police have 10 days to get an attorney. And so all the provisions that would be there to hold someone accountable in other types of violence are not, the police are not being held to the same standard.
One thing I do want to talk about here before we go as well is, Lisa, maybe you should talk about this, which is there's a bill out, the difference between protective and peace orders bill. Could you talk a bit about that? I meant to get that early. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful bill. That's Senate Bill 477 and House Bill 606. And right now there are two types of orders that people can use to get protection. One of them is a peace order and the other one's a protective order. Peace orders are for disputes between neighbors. You know, your neighbor cuts down your tulips and, you know, you get a peace order.
Right.
Right? You know, protective orders are more serious. They're longer. They're twice as long. There are all sorts of different options about very serious cases and permanent orders and two-year orders. And one of the most important things is that people with protective orders get lethality assessments so we can really identify the people that are the highest risk. And so right now, kind of weirdly, we've got dating violence and sexual assault outside of the intimate partner context. Those are all in the peace order category with the tulip cases. So we want to move it out of the peace order and into the protective order category. And this would really help in college sexual assault cases. It would help in those long-term
dating
cases.
It'll help homeless women. It'll help folks in shelters. It's really a good bill.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another one of those bills that we have just run into roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And with so many new delegates, so many new senators, we're hoping that the leadership of the Judicial Proceedings Committee and the leadership of Judiciary really takes these up and just votes them. Again, just like vote them up or down. We're kind of done with the idea of just not having these important women's issues not even addressed and not even voted on. It's time to, you know, to make your members vote and to tell the public.
And these are all still in committee?
These are also in committee. The dating violence bill was heard on Friday in the House Judiciary Committee, and I guess it's been a couple of weeks for the dating violence bill in the Senate. Neither committee has voted on them yet.
And Mathana, a closing thought.
I believe what is critical here is to know that regardless of your interests, like some people are more inclined to policy while others are more inclined to donating to shelter programs, despite your particular interests, do something. It's all of us can't do everything, but everybody can do something. Get involved with these organizations. Go on the website. Thank you, Mark, for posting the information on your site so that people can access it there and your listeners can have access to that. But don't just sit back. Take an active stance in some area or arena that's going to allow us to make a collective movement forward.
These are really important. I know Lisa Jordan, executive director and legislative counsel for the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You have to roll right now. So thank you so much for being with us. It's been great to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time. And please listen to my colleagues and everybody. If you could just make some phone calls, I ask everyone who wants to support victims of sexual assault, survivors of sexual violence, just do three things during our legislative session. I don't care what they are. They could be three emails. They could be three phone calls. They could be a visit to Annapolis and two phone calls. Just do three things during this 90-day legislative session, and you will really make a difference.
And Jackie Rabarge, a closing thought from you, because on all your work over these years and where you think this all is now, what people can do.
Yeah, I really want to thank Lisa, especially for her work in Annapolis, and Mathina for her tireless advocacy around issues of trauma. And I really want folks to look at all the different pieces to the puzzle and make sure that the women that are most impacted by race, class, and gender are not cut out of the legislative process, because like they said, the devil is in the details, and the devils are in the details. And I really think there are some of these bills that are very complicated. We need to play the tape all the way out before we rush ahead towards further penalties and criminalization.
This has been very important, and I'm glad we can get all these people on this program for this conversation. You just heard Jackie Rabarge. Jackie Rabarge is founder and director of Power Inside, a project of Fusion Partnerships. And just before that, Lisa Jordan, and before that, Mathina James Brightful, Director of Community Education and Training with Turnaround Inc., and Visionary Director for Heal a Woman, Heal a Nation. And Mathina and Lisa, I know Lisa, I just had a run in, Jackie, thank you so much. And we'll have this on our website to give people an easier way to access this and understand what is going on. And on our way to break here, we're hearing Lou Reed, This Magic Moment. Today is the great singer, songwriter, guitarist, producer, and actor's birthday. Happy birthday, Lou Reed. We'll be right back.